Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Neil and Kristen Recycled Hour. Here we are on Tuesday, not our normal day, but hoping that some of you know we're on the air. 914-338-0164 is the call-in number. Please press 1 if you'd like to speak with us. And we would love it if you joined us on our social media channels or networks or whatever they're called. I don't know. Anyway, Facebook, Twitter, and those accounts are linked on our Blog Talk Radio profile. And what I am trying to do currently is post to our pages. It used to be that you could post to the pages directly from Blog Talk Radio. It was seamless. Now they've redone the pages on Facebook, so you're unable to you can't post from Facebook to the pages. You can only post from Facebook to whatever page is connected, like your personal page. Then you have to go in manually and post to your other pages. It's extremely irritating. So I'm trying to figure out how to do that right now.
It's amazing how, as time goes by, you're supposed to improve.
This is not improved.
Your situation, and most time things get deteriorate.
Yeah, that's what's happening
but
right now.
The process of life. As you get older, things deteriorate.
Well, but that's not the idea here. I don't get it. Frustrating. Anyway, talk while I try to post the show here.
It's a significant topic because as we get older, usually we gradually climb to our perfection. And then at some point in time, we either maintain it or we indeed start to deteriorate and things start to fall apart. Naturally, the process of life will it's predetermined that we ultimately fall apart as we get older, except for the few of us who seem to manage and wade through the process of aging and
continue to be formed
under a symbol of excellence.
Except, and the exception, of course, would also be people that die before they have the opportunity to decline into old age and so on and so forth. And I'm posting, it's just spinning the wheel. What is going on?
But the process of our system of activity throughout life is also somewhat predetermined by the code of our birth date in terms of what we may be facing. But every number that is a theme in our birth date can be counteracted by our willpower. So we're not inclined to be subject to our birthday codes as much as we are also eligible for higher activity in spite of what our numbers say. Our numbers will still give us certain positions of karma, but we can, in some form, actually transcend that karma into something higher if we have the capabilities of mind, body, and soul to do it. So I've never really experienced a successful outcome from giving into negativity. It doesn't seem to work. So it also doesn't seem to work to try to defy certain amounts of karma. So you either combat the karma or you learn to live with it and make the most of it.
Well,
adjust yourself. One with adjustment.
I mean, giving into negative energy, no. But sometimes you use negative energy in order to affect an outcome.
Well, if you're using negative energy in order to affect that outcome, you're converting the negative energy, perhaps, into something that is a different definition of negativity. So there is an attitude that one can approach with negative force. See, that's different. That's negative force. That's not negative subordination. It's something that compels one to use negativity in order to force a result. So, yeah, we do that constantly through our lifetime. Small is trying to unwedge a tight screw. You combating negative forces with negative energy. You know, like a war situation, battling your enemy. So there is, yeah, there is a certain form, because it becomes, it's converted into energy. And that's why we have our positive and negative points. Even in a battery, car battery, we have positive and negative outlets and elements. So in that regard, what you're really discussing is how to find a certain region of balance within any given situation. Maybe you have to apply more negative energy or more positive, or converting it, maneuvering it. It's all sort of part of the improvisational theater of our life, that we have to work in such a way to bring out an adequate form of balance. And sometimes it can be very challenging. Sometimes it can be very, very challenging when your life is immediately threatened, if you're drowning, or think of, you know, positions of genocide, the Holocaust, being in a region where there's suddenly a lot of violence going on. Our first reaction is to try to avoid the violence. And if we can't, if we're imprisoned by it or restricted by in movement, then we have to learn how to deal with some part of our body, mind, and soul in order to adjust to the situation. Now, that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with one's birthday. If your life is threatened, you don't go look at your birthday and go, well, see, let me see what I'm supposed to do here. It has to do with the energy of your mind, body, and soul. And it also has to do with, like what you said, sometimes you have to apply negative energy in order to find the proper solution to your own immediate survival. So that is true. And we do have more than a knack. We have a inward bred energy to protect ourselves by reflex and nothing else. If something's coming at you, whether you like life or not, you're usually the duck. It has nothing to do with attitude. It has to do with the physicality of the survival of oneself. So there is that initial energy that is a part of our life. Touch an insect and it's going to run or fly away. Not examining the aspects of existence, it's just responding to a physical brain, physicality. So yeah, in that part, you have to deal with a certain amount of negative energy in order to restore or maintain your existence.
It's true, and you mentioned people that are dealing with genocide or, you know, in conflict, war conflict or, you know, these dramatic situations. Most of the people that we're dealing with are not, calling us from the battlefields of the Ukraine. So their situations are different, obviously. You know, it's not the approach that one is going to take towards someone who is in a true crisis where their lives are being threatened is going to be different than someone who is who's struggling through the more average aspects of existence that are challenging to a human being.
Yeah, there is a clear definition about what we really mean by violence or have some kind of issue going on.
Well, and it's not to say that there aren't people that are, domestic violence, or having their own individualized problems and that are severe or extreme. Maybe they're suffering from illness or, like I said, victims of domestic violence or having discord in their family environment. There's a distinction between that and, being in a war-torn country trying to survive, on the most basic levels of survival.
Yeah, it's a tough call. I've noticed a lot of times in the readings, most of the readings take a pleasure principle. I see good things coming for you. I see roses around you. You're going through a big change. You're going to love it. The attitude of finding comfort in a reading doesn't always match the principle of reality. And unfortunately, we don't ascribe to just giving flowery readings.
With that said, giving flowery readings, a general reading, I see good things coming for you. You're going to be coming up on changes. Those are all generalizations. If those generalizations are made, they're going to be backed up in our readings with validations that support those generalizations. I put quotations around the word generalizations because I guess if they're being validated, then they're not generalizations. Then there's some, validity to what is being advised.
Yeah, on a natural level, the components of change are sometimes very, very subtle in the natural world. So when we were more attuned to the natural language of the world, we would know by the very sense of the air when the season was changing. We didn't have to look at the calendar. We would know when rain was coming. We were attuned to the natural language of the world. And in some respects, we've lost that. We've relied on inventions and instruments, but we've lost that natural instinct. Not all of us, people who are closely rooted to the earth, still understands that the earth is continuously speaking to us. And the languages in the earth are as varied as the languages in the human population. There's always a language going on the planet, and there's always a place to interpret that language, even if it has to do with the subtlety of what that energy is. But there's constant movement. There's movement in everything that is around us, even in still life. There is movement. There's molecular activity. So we've got this energy going on, even when one says, stand still, don't move. Impossible. Impossible. Your heart is beating. You're blinking. You're breathing. To stand still, even if you're dead, you're moving. You're rotting. You're decomposing. There's movement in everything in the earth, even if it has to do with decay. Everything is moving. And when the body is completely decomposed, the energy is still there. The air we breathe is still the air that George Washington breathed, the air that Napoleon breathed. We're constantly in the motion of molecular energy. And it's in us. when a psychic using that energy, then they're really taking in the universal concepts of existence.
That's why you're wearing a powdered wig today.
Yeah.
I couldn't figure it out. I was trying with all my might to determine why you were
about my axe.
even when it was swinging at me.
Right.
Which brings up again our survival.
But it is at least an astral fact that we are part of everything that ever existed on this planet. It's in us in some form.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Everything is in us. So we have parts of us that are a composite. The parts represent a composite of all existence. Now, in that form, we sometimes specify what we want to choose. You go to a library and you choose a book you want off the shelf. But that doesn't mean that the library doesn't house tons of subjects. So sometimes what we pull out of the shelf of our mindset are specific topics that we want to focus on. But yet at the same time, something's always happening. That's why in the midst of our venture to complete a task, things happen. Things change. Things happen. Things beyond our control. Because in the library of our existence, there are going to be topics where books are flying off the shelf, whether you like it or not. And sometimes it's good things, surprises. Which gets us into the idea of when people are at a standstill, they usually use the term hope. Do you see me winning the lottery? Do you see my Prince Charming come? Something. There's always this idea that we start to develop out of the fabric of reality, of existence, these hopeful ideas, however fanciful they may be. Now, that's still part of the scope of our mind reaching out for something that is beyond our immediate capture, something that we can start to dream about. So when we get into that idea, that's why Chris and I delve deeply into dream symbolism and interpret dreams, hopefully accurately, because the dream world itself is multi-layered. Whether it's existing within the scope of one's recognition of history, of current or past, or whether it's reaching out into the element and realm of the astral regions, where the soul is receiving information and then sending it back to the sleeping body, the astral body, you're receiving it back to the physical body, because the soul does not venture out with the brain. It ventures out with a different perception of energy that's not brain-centered. So there's a consciousness in the soul, which means that our brains are backed up by an astral intelligence. We have an astral intelligence. When we talk to ghosts and spirits, we're not communicating to them via their brain. Their brain is gone. So what is this element, what is this mystery of language that occurs beyond the breath of human life? That's the question that we start to get into to define what you were saying about how forces of energy, whether it's positive or negative, can transcend their very definition. This is communication of the body transcends into communication of the soul and spirit. Now, to bring that down to the basics of life, one still has to apply those higher principles to even the most minute details of existence. You know, getting up in the morning, deciding what you're going to have for breakfast, part of the process. that stems back to the idea of getting up in the morning and deciding how you're going to hunt for your breakfast, or how you're going to fawn for your breakfast, you know, hunter-gatherer. It wasn't that, you know, you went to the drawer and pulled out a box of cereal. There was no industry, no commodity like that. So everything was based on the will, on the instinctual physical patterns of existence. We still have that. That's still within us somewhere.
Well, you know, the interesting part of that, I'm sorry, I'm in the middle of trying to, our post for our page, look at our, it's all messed up. So I'm trying to adjust our post and delete it here. Trash. What I was going to say is it's interesting. You talk about industry and food and the fact that, you know, of course, in eras bygone, you know, cereal was, didn't exist. I mean, a box of cereal, you were harvesting your food for consumption. And then, you know, the idea now that everything is, I mean, you know, some people obviously live off the land and are, or, you know, hunter gatherers, whatever. But the fact that we are influenced by what we eat, I mean, who knows what kind of chemicals we're consuming when we buy box cereal, whether it's natural or not natural, you know, a major brand, meaning that there's probably bioengineered products in it. And so how that affects us.
Genetically engineered alterations of a natural product. But we have, I mean, our first method of converting raw material into food had to do with the sun, the original oven, and water, which was the original mixture. It was sun and water. And when you talk about breakfast, or, you know, you talk about oats or wheat or barley, or the Egyptians are cultivating and beginning to formulate that, there was a process that what could the body and the teeth handle? So even in prehistoric times, everything was taken down to either you ripped it apart with your molar teeth, or you chewed it, or you mashed it up with a rock, grind it down. And then whatever was appealing to the
appealing to the
digestion system, it became incorporated in the habits of whatever colony or tribe or species that was happening to eat. It's amazing that there are meat eaters and there are herbivores. You don't usually see a deer, you know, chasing a rabbit and eating it. There are scavengers, but
like
we
crows.
Have this division, the hunter-gatherer, the idea that our origins come from such a space that there are distinctions in the attitude of how we connect and relate and consume our environment or survive by it. The same thing's with the soul. The soul has a certain division of energy in which it operates as a hunter, as a gatherer, as an intellect, as a worker. Everything is geared towards us, the occupation of our existence. So, and it's separated. There's a certain segregation of profession. Doctors don't usually hang out with plumbers. I mean, they can, but doctors usually talk to doctors. Plumbers talk to plumbers, that kind of thing. With exception.
Well, I mean,
but
you know.
We classify ourselves, and thereby we limit, in many ways, our experience.
doctor.
Except we're Benjamin Franklin and we're all around scientists and politicians.
So,
you talk
about class. I mean, that's what it's all about. So, I mean, plumbers may not necessarily only hang out with plumbers, but generally people of a certain class stick with their own, with their specific class. So, you know, a plumber might hang out with a painter.
Right.
A doctor might hang out with a lawyer.
But the professional language becomes restricted. The professional language becomes restricted, and we all take on some aspect of teaching. All of us are built in to teach, whether it's a plumber coming and telling the customer, you know, what's all about plumbing, or even on the road, somebody signaling that they are changing lanes is teaching that person that there's a movement about to be made. And that the signal there is that you are teaching the person to be cautious. That you're sending a signal to them. So we have this idea that it's very difficult to not be a teacher, to not express oneself in such a way that there's a certain absolute quality of mind, body, and spirit going on, even as we live and breathe. There's always some kind of movement, always something we have to listen to. Now, when we get down to the specifics of questions, it's a different matter. And oftentimes we'll have these deep discussions and we'll get a caller, we'll just sort of go directly to their question at hand.
Probably because they, you know, in their defense, looking for a show on Blog Talk Radio to call and aren't, you know, listening to the conversation that preceded their call. They're just wanting a reading and seeing that readings are being done.
Yeah.
So that's why.
Which is fine. I mean, that's part of the function of the show, is to answer people's questions. And when we do get a caller, we always draw forth the topic and address the caller and move into their energy field, adapting our language to their concerns. So there's always that immediacy of movement. That's what we consider to be improvisational theater in terms of one's life. And you're always ready to improvise and adjust to any given situation at hand. I think that one has to ask oneself a question. What is the most important thing I have to do in the day? What happens to most people? They mostly say, well, I have to mail these letters. I have to pay this bill. I have to call the landlord. Most of our important messages of the day have to do with our daily activity when you think about it. Now, there are those who say the most important thing I have to do today is read a book and learn something. The most important thing I have to do today is go outside and connect to nature. Most of us find that the important things of the day regard our first basic level of survival. And it's usually mundane.
Yeah, food, what do we need to get from the grocery store, what kind of order needs to be placed, the laundry, you know, sweeping the leaves.
Now think about it, as we've become more sophisticated, it's layered. The most important thing is to get up, get dressed, brush your teeth, have something to eat, get in the car, drive to work, get into work, greet people, look to see what's on the desk, start to take phone calls, start to activate our profession. Everything is suddenly in a row of what we need to do, and our mind is preoccupied with a concurrency of events that are somewhat mundane, because they don't reach deep into existence unless you're a fireman maybe or a doctor or something that already is in the environment of some form of ultimate life and death importance. Most of us do not spend our layered moments dealing with heavy topics. They're just the activity at hand. And it's a shame because there's parts of our brain that have to go on reserve for such a, natures of immediate survival. There's no question about it. We have to do it. But what does that mean? So what people do is, well, when I get off work, I'll go work out. When I get off work, I'm going to go to my meditation class. When I get off work, I'm going to swim in the ocean. There seems to be something that our brain needs beyond being just an automaton of energy that is conditioned to just take care at the active events at hand. So there's far-reaching energy fields in our intelligence that, or even above and beyond energy. I know that some of us get through life through imagery. If we have a horrible topic that we have to deal with or drudgery of life, we begin to use our musings as a form of release. We start to visualize things, or we get excited about something. Even if it's something as mundane, oh, there's going to be my great TV show's on tonight. Can't wait to get home. I'm going to take a hot bath. Something that helps us to lift ourselves out of the immediacy of an ordained, mundane routine of life. And think about it. Think about what the soul needs in order to be nourished above and beyond the energies, which brings us back to appreciating the movements of the planet. If it's whether it's solitary or coming home to pat your dog. But there's always something in our journey of life that is demanding above and beyond our major immediate concerns, topics that bring us into full attention when we're concerned. That's why we empathize with people who really don't care about these deep conversations. They've got problems they're dealing with. So that's always a rational approach to getting off the topic of the depth of existence and dealing with someone's immediate concerns. But it is still part of the movement of survival. And that's just the way we view it. God knows it's a journey just to read the newspaper.
Well, yeah, I mean, the fact is, whether or not they're, if someone's a deep person or not, or involved in depth more often, more frequently than the average individual, the fact is, the bills still need to be paid, and those mundane tasks need to be done. And so, involving yourself in being a responsible, functioning member of society isn't only, being philosophical and reflective, but taking care of your everyday responsibilities, obviously.
Yeah, it is a search that we have to look immediately at our environment. But let's assume for a minute that the immediacy of your environment is encroached upon by the attention to the world. So when you're reading the newspaper, usually there's the front page and the events going on in the world, sometimes specific to your location. Then you have a second section that is more specified to your location. Then you have a sports section. Then you have a entertainment section. And all of this is about the printed word and news surrounding us. And it's all part of the corporation that we live. I hate to say it, but we live in a village. We live in a community of mind, body, and spirit.
I know, it's just stupid. I hate that expression.
Yeah.
It takes a village. It doesn't always take a village. But anyway, that's another topic. It's so
like
cliche.
No worries. It's a cliche that we've developed, maybe from some vast, deep origin of thought that was specified in terms of the locale and everything. But I know when I read the paper every day, I'm just, it's a job, not entertainment. It may be part of your instinct of wanting to gather what's going on in the world, but getting through the paper is a tragedy.
Yeah.
You can't, how can you really read what's going on in the world and feel fulfilled? You have to reserve your attention to something so you don't go bonkers.
I think that's why the content of journalism has declined, in my opinion, in what's printed in the paper. And most people that are listening probably don't even get a paper because they get their news online. So the idea of a physical paper, I mean, the physical newspaper is dying because everything is moved online. But anyway, aside from that, reading the Sunday paper the other day, the articles were so many frustrating articles. I mean, because, you know, there's these human interests. I feel like there are more human interest articles or, you know, these not editorial pieces, because they're not really editorial. I don't know what you call them. Personal stories filling the pages, which to me, why are these articles there? I think probably to capture a reader that may not be as interested in reading about world events as another. So they're trying to balance the content with lighter material, which to me doesn't really belong in a newspaper necessarily. I mean, editorial pieces or opinion pieces, yes, but you know, there's these stupid stories about dating and you know, how I met my partner and these, I mean, it's like, what? This is in a newspaper?
Well, you know, journalism, takes on different forms. Saturday Evening Post would have human element stories. Back in the 70s, a new term came out called the new journalism. New journalism. People like Tom Wolfe and Susan Sontag and Kurt Vonnegut, and people were writing in an area that was called the new journalism, meaning that it took on a slant that became personalized and a little bit more advanced in the form of the cold, bare facts and figures. So it took on, the new journalism took on a certain form of personality. In some regard, the newscaster Walter Winchell was a form of human journalism that took on a certain opinionated aspect of gossip,
which isn't so bad.
Knowledge.
Herb Cain was a columnist, but it was, you know, he's now deceased, but famous, and he, you know, there was that element to his column where there was, you know, it was the going on and happenings of the local area that he reported on, and there was opinion there, but it was also done in a way that it was written in a way that was elevated. I mean, these other articles that I'm talking about are crap. I think there's been a decline. I mean, and the paper, the newspaper, the printed paper is full of advertisements. Yeah. So that's what's paying to keep the paper alive, obviously.
Well, I mean, it's nothing new. I remember in the 60s, my history teacher bemoaning the fact that the paper was really, the paper was really advertisements with a tracing of content. You'd have vast advertisements. And so the paper, it became a catch-22. We have to have advertising to give you the news. And the bigger the advertising, the more we can supply you with the news. So the news took a certain corner of, you know, it wasn't like Steele's a robot where you had these little captions and vast content around them that would emphasize who the sponsors and the people who were supporting the paper were all about, paying for advertisements. Now the advertisements will be one full picture of a lady looking at you because she wants to sell a perfume. What? You know, to, in our world, we've sort of, the erosion of really being world-weary has been replaced by the aspect of 1984, where you just give in to Big Brother and forget about what's going on in the world and reach for the brightest color that makes you feel good. So we're sort of in that attitude that so many people have forewarned us about, even HULs, going back to the idea that we're becoming a world where our consciousness is evaporating and becoming more attuned to a diversion of information. There's always that threat. Even in, when you talk about journalism, we have now specified whether we're reading The Nation or The New Republic or National Review, Time Magazine, Esquire, Atlantic, New Yorker. You know, when we look at the news, McCall's, everything is sort of like geared
towards a certain type of...
a certain topic.
Right, a topic or a slant, liberal, conservative, or, you know, specialized, you know, as far as someone's interest field. However, you have to consider the fact that these companies that are, you know, these, you know, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, what else, what's another one? I'm trying to think of conservative. What's a conservative?
National Review,
but there's others that I'm not able to think of. But the point is that these magazines or newspapers are all owned by, I mean, the number of companies that own all the journalism media companies, including what's televised, CNN, ABC, there's like three companies that own all of these subsidiaries, meaning that the information that we're getting, even though you think, okay, well, this is coming from a liberal perspective or this is coming from a conservative perspective, the slant is, I mean, there's bias already because of the fact that it's not from an independent source. These are companies that are owned by major conglomerates. So the news that we're getting is totally controlled.
In many cases, there are publications and periodicals that will try to find the middle ground and debate the issues. And some of them claim,
maybe,
even when they're slanted, to be doing such things. There was always that great debate between William Buckley and I think it was Norman Mailer, where the two would tell and fight off liberal and conservative viewpoints. And both were intellectual giants in their own right. Buckley was always accused of the long-winded sentences and complicated words, and he'd go on and on, but he was a representative of being conservative.
So what time period are we talking about?
Back in the 60s and 70s.
Well, yeah, so there was more freedom of the press in those days. Now, I mean, I just read or watched, I can't remember what it was, a special regarding the, I can't remember if I read it or watched it, about the decline of journalism, and it was pertaining to a specific newspaper in Northern California, San Jose Mercury, which was once like heralded as a excellent source of unbiased information, and how they've been bought out by a major company, and you know, now it's homogenized material. So even if you're getting a liberal slant and there are liberal articles within, I just, you know, I don't trust. I mean, I don't trust what I read necessarily as being true.
Well, you have to go to more radical publications that supposedly speak the truth.
Then there are those.
They are, you know, maybe socialist or ultra-liberal the New Republic and
but who is the New Republic owned by? Let's find out.
There's somebody that will reach deep the New Republic. They reach deep into the in-depth study of journalism, just as Nixon's case was broken up by Woodward and Hollywood and what's the other guy's name? He recently just passed away too, from one of the journalists. But journalists are in trouble. They're in trouble all around the world. And so to speak the truth is very, very dangerous. Even in Mexico, you'll be killed if you get too close to the truth. Journalists were supposed to be immune to violence. They were there to report the facts. But now it's a dangerous job. It's just as much as being a fireman. It's a dangerous job. So the journalism, it derives from the journal of life, the reporting of facts and figures that are going on in the world, and to seek the truth of a situation is sometimes just the ability to report what one witnesses without commentary. You just report what one witnesses. So there's an attitude in the pure nature of journalism. A journalist would wrap up their ideas in their concluding paragraphs, but it would be based upon the facts that they gathered. And then there was always this pocket of personal attitude that would be that ventured out into the form of editorials and things like that. But true journalism was sometimes the gathering of facts and reporting of facts. Then there was always a reservation of a paragraph with the conclusion of what these facts actually mean, or what the slant would mean, hoping that would activate some sort of reaction of activism on the part of the reader, or the awareness of the political scheme. So we have that part of life where there's a value in reporting what one sees in conjunction with what one believes. So there was always this mixture going on that gradually eroded into diversions. So we start to get diverted. You could say that the comic strips in the newspaper are the antithesis of news. What does that have to do with news? Why do we have to have comics? Where did that get started? Is it the page of relief and brevity of concern?
Are you talking about the opinion pages?
Well, I'm talking about the comic section of the newspaper.
The comics. Okay.
Why do we have this? Why are we diverted? Do we need this diversion to take away from the facts and figures of what's going on in the world? What is this form of entertainment? So when you talk about articles being inane and benign and ridiculous or superficial, it seems as though human beings can only handle so much unless they're into the idea that give me as much as I can handle, because I want to know what's going on in the world, and I want to choose what I will put myself into and participate in the trial of life.
Yeah. Well, in the weekend section of the LA Times, this was in April, on red flag alert, I finally spoke up and stopped settling for less than I deserve. Why? Why is this interesting to me as a reader and as a weekend article? I mean, maybe for some people it's an interesting article, but for me, I was like, why is this even in the paper? If there's a special section for, you know, people that are seeking love or whatever, or I don't know.
Well, maybe part of the news is that there's a universal concept that we're still human beings and we're able to express ourselves with even superficial pleasure and safety. This is part of being a, you know, why have Ann Landers?
I get it. It just, the content of the article to me wasn't good, and it was just and there's always an article in the weekend section that I'm wondering to myself, why is this in here? Why I do not find anything interesting about it whatsoever. But I want to get back to really quickly the New Republic, because the New Republic was bought in 2012 by the co-founder of Facebook, which was, there's, you're never going to have, an unbiased publication, and you're never going to, you have to look at the owner of the publication, figure out where they're coming from in terms of their views and their standpoint. Obviously, the owner, co-founder of Facebook, to me, I'm not going to find trustworthy, but the magazine was actually sold in 2016 to Wynn McCormick. He's the editor-in-chief of the magazine, and he's the editor-in-chief of Tin House Magazine and Tin House Books.
And did they slant it as liberal or conservative or socialist?
I believe it's liberal.
Yeah, it's a liberal magazine.
I believe it's a liberal magazine.
And a little bit towards socialism. A little bit. But there are, articles. I remember, much to my dismay, when Newsweek was taken out of publication, because the giants of more popularized news were Time and Newsweek. They were the two giants of more popularized news events that had a variety of topics within their content. And then Newsweek was finally folded. And Time still exists, somewhat in a variation of what it originally was. Articles have now become more condensed and not as lengthy. But there's still that topic that even if you look on the front page of the Time magazine, they'll try to sort out the personal from the impersonal, meaning that sometimes a cover is filled with a personality and, you're going to learn about the famous actress or actor that just did his movie and they put their picture on the front page.
Or a politician.
Or they designed their front page with some worldly event that's at hand. Whatever sells the news, whatever is that variety of information that we derive from.
And the New Republic, I guess, is leaning towards socialism because they criticize the Democratic Party. So it's beyond the liberal stance of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Personally,
I subscribe to very, very various magazines just because my brain wants to absorb everything that's going on, whether I trust it or not. I still want to know what's going on in the printed world.
Well.
But the part of doing that, another great publication is Foreign Affairs.
That's more conservative, isn't it?
Well, not really. There's a conservative slant. Its report is really about foreign affairs. And
so it's
written by different politicians and commentators. And it's really an academic publication. There's not going to be any advertising in it. Maybe a little box. But it's really essays and reporting on what's happening around the world in terms of foreign affairs. But it gives you a more in-depth. The essays are lengthy. They're 12 to 20 pages. And it's just another in-depth variety of news. I don't know how we got on all this topic.
I don't know, but I like Cosmopolitan. It's one of my favorites.
I like to find the little figures in the trees. But anyways, that's our show.
Yeah, we're back on the air next week, Wednesday, at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern. Speak with you then. Bye-bye.